And welcome back for another episode of Sea Control, a podcast series brought to you by the Centre of International Maritime Security. I'm Natalie Sambi, and I'm an analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute in Canberra, and I'm the host of the Asia-Pacific leg of Sea Control. And thanks again for joining us. But before we get to the meat and bones of our talk today, we'll be back after this short break.
Do you like the Sea Control podcast? Sure, we all do. However, we're only a small sea in the ocean of content available to you, our dear listener, at the SimSec website. Sign up for a membership at www.cimsec.org/about/membership. China may have a 9-dash line, but our seas are clear, and we welcome your opinions and articles. Please take a moment while downloading this podcast to leave us a 5-star rating and a comment. We need them. Seriously, how do you think we pay this electric bill? Money?
And thanks again for joining us for another episode of Sea Control. Don't forget, you can catch all of SimSec's past podcasts on iTunes or its website on simsec.org, and you can also follow them on Twitter at SimSec. That's C-I-M-S-E-C. So today, we'll be talking about Japan. Japan has recently announced that it'll increase its defense budget to almost $42 billion US, the largest absolute sum in the country's history. Japan's defense minister noted the increase was due to the quote-unquote changing situation around Japan, quote, to protect Japan's air, sea, and land, and guard the lives and properties of its citizens. The defense minister also stated that China engaged in, quote, dangerous actions that destabilized the region. And in recent years, tensions over the disputed Senkaku Daiyu Islands have heightened, and regional states have watched as China has employed military and non-military assets in the South China Sea to intimidate states like the Philippines and Vietnam. So what impact do Japan's budgetary plans have? And what does Japan's more activist foreign and defense postures mean? For this and more, I'm joined today by two guests. I'm joined by Dr. Malcolm Cook, who is a visiting fellow at ISEAS in Singapore, and with ASPE's Dr. Ben Shriya, who works on Northeast Asia policy. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining me today.
Oh, pleasure.
Good morning.
Malcolm, if I could just start with you, would you like to give our audience just a quick one-line bio about what you're doing in Singapore, and then Ben, I'll get you to follow.
Yeah, I'm a senior fellow at the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies, primarily focused on the major power security interests in Southeast Asia, the United States, China, and Japan being those major powers.
And I'm a senior analyst for defense strategy at ASPE, mostly working on the intersection between strategy, strategic trends, and defense capabilities in the Asia-Pacific.
All right. And thanks very much for joining me again. And look, let's just kick off with this question that's appeared in the news about Japan's defense budget. Why has this happened, and what does it mean? Malcolm, can I start with you?
Yeah, I guess the first point, if you look at the Japanese defense budget for netto-yen terms, it's actually only about the same as the 2007 defense budget and about 5-7% less than the 2002 one. So while in nominal terms it is the largest ever, as most defense budgets are, in real terms, taking into consideration inflation, Japan in 2015 is spending as much on defense as it did in 2007. So I think the headlines in that sense are a little bit misleading.
Ben?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. I mean, there are two figures that have been floating around. One was used by The Economist, who came up with a figure of, I think, 4.98 trillion yen to say that this has been the biggest Japanese defense spending since the Second World War. But the Defense News quoted directly from the Japanese Ministry of Defense, and there the figure was 4.82, and that's quite, well, that's closer to what Malcolm just said. So when you look at Japanese defense spending since about 1997, this actually, that figure, 4.82, which I think is much closer to the mark, or actually reflects the total amount, well, is within the 2007-2006 range, and it is below 1% of GDP, and it is, well, the third consecutive increase. So Abe is making true on his promise to increase defense spending despite a still dire overall economic predicament, so we don't know what happens to Abenomics, but it is not that, you know, revolutionary record spending sort of Japan taking off to unknown sphere. So yeah, I totally agree with Malcolm.
Well, if it's not about the numbers necessarily, and it's what they do with the money, what can you say about where Japan's headed with these new figures?
Yeah, I think if you look at this defense budget as the defense agency proposed or defense ministry proposed, and even the last year, there's clearly a shift in emphasis and in money away from the ground self-defense force or the army, particularly towards the Air Force, which at the moment has about a budget that's 50% less than the ground self-defense force. But there's a clear shift in personnel, but particularly in material terms, away from the army and what they call static defense towards the Air Force or air self-defense and maritime self-defense, particularly focusing on remote islands in the south of Japan that are in dispute with China. So the numbers aren't, so Japan is shifting its balance between the three defense forces towards maritime and air capabilities, and particularly wanting to maintain an air superiority over its southern islands.
Yeah, again, I there's not much where I would disagree. I mean, what this budget basically allows is to implement some of the key defense reforms that have been going on for quite some time.
Can you articulate just what some of those reforms are?
Well, for instance, increasing capabilities in the areas of anti-submarine warfare, upgrading defense ballistic missile defense capabilities on destroyers, developing a nascent but I would say pretty impressive amphibious capability, buying joint strike fighters to improve air defense over the southernmost islands. But these are capability initiatives that have been agreed upon for quite some time. So what the budget does is making sure that the STF can meet those requirements.
Has there been any impetus for this particular announcement?
Certainly, as noted by the Japanese Minister of Defense, the language they use to define Japan's security environment each year, even before Abe, gets worse. So I think it's now a very severe environment with a particular focus on two threats, the threat in the East China Sea from China, and they note that last year they scrambled, the Air Self-Defense Force scrambled over 300 times jet fighters to any flyovers into what Japan sees as its air national airspace. The other one, ballistic missile defense expenditures on Aegis, is the missile threat both from China and from North Korea. So the defense budget and these quite major purchases of air and maritime capabilities are focused particularly on those two threats, and also on strengthening the U.S.-Japan alliance by increasing Japan's contribution or burden sharing to the alliance.
Actually, I was going to get to the U.S. but a bit later, but let's get to that now. I mean, as part of the overall defense policy, I've noted here, Malcolm, in your paper that you talk about four major pillars in Japan's grand strategy. And just for our listeners, I'll articulate what they are. Number one, it's improving national and economic international revitalization. Number two, as you mentioned, strengthening the U.S.-Japan alliance. Number three, building up regional security cooperation, which also includes security architecture. And number four, enhancing bilateral relationships with states in the region. Turning now to the U.S.-Japan alliance, what have been the major changes in that relationship there? What's really key?
I guess if you look at last year, probably the single biggest Japanese change in favor of the alliance was the reinterpretation of the Constitution to allow limited collective self-defense. That is very much targeted at Japan being able to contribute more or situations where the United States, for example, may be under attack from, for example, an intercontinental missile fired from either China or North Korea. Collective self-defense now allows Japan not only to track those missiles heading tonight towards the United States, but potentially shoot them down as well. So that was a very difficult political decision by Abe, opposed even by his coalition Parlamento, and they pushed it through primarily to, as I say, provide a stronger Japan leg to the U.S.-Japan alliance.
You know, what Malcolm's just outlined, Ben, what are the challenges ahead for Japan in implementing this, and what other challenges are there in the U.S.-Japan relationship?
Well, I think this year, later in the year, we will see an important litmus test for the alliance when both sides are publishing the revised defense guidelines. And the first draft was quite interesting in that it talked about a global role of the alliance, in that it talked about a broader, well, role of Japan within the alliance as outlined by Malcolm. And we have to see what the final draft or what the final document in the end really looks like.
And when's that due again, sorry?
Well, it has been, to my knowledge, postponed until May. That was my last information on that, and we have to see whether that will happen and what the final document looks like. But it could be that the revised guidelines really paved the way for a more active role of Japan within the U.S. alliance. In terms of challenges, I think there's still sort of some unknowns about the specific domestic context within which Abe has to operate. So what is the political support, particularly by its coalition partner, but the broader Japanese population in general for more, greater Japanese role. I think it's more fragile than often perceived from the outside. I think Abe knows that quite well. Malcolm just mentioned the big push for a constitutional reinterpretation on collective self-defense. I think the other thing that Abe somehow needs to resolve is a new understanding on self-defense, under which conditions can the SDF, can the Japanese Self-Defense Force defend themselves. That is another unresolved issue, and we will have to wait and see whether Abe actually finds the political majority to do that. So I guess these are the biggest challenges. And then there's the economic question, the question about, well, the overall state of the Japanese economy, which is tied to some uncertainties about the world economy in general, and in other words, well, what's the scope for Abe to invest in these defense capabilities? But so far, I must say, I think that the Japanese spending is sound. So people have criticized the defense budget, saying it's not enough. I think it's actually within the political context quite a sound funding base.
All right. I want to come back to political support in a second, but Malcolm, I hope you caught all of that, but I just wanted to get your comments on the economics and, the, as Ben put it, the sound level of defense spending of Japan.
Yeah, I guess, you know, if you're looking for headline-grabbing figures, I think Japan's public debt is now approaching 250% of GDP.
Ouch.
The World Bank says anything above 50% of GDP is a worry. So Japan's fiscal situation is very difficult and not improving. So any agency or ministry getting budget increases is doing well, particularly ones that might not have as much public support as more spending on aged care or health, for example.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, if there is, as Ben described it, sort of a lot more fractured political support for these kinds of moves, how did Abe do this? How is this going ahead?
I guess if you look, Yeah, one is, you know, the political system in Japan is even more fractured, where there isn't at the moment an effective opposition that can really challenge Abe's ruling coalition. So Abe is in a politically powerful position to push things through that may not even be popularly supported, like turning on nuclear power stations again, which will start next year as well.
Well, maybe just adding to that, if you look at the, you know, this year's federal budget, what the government is trying to do is increase the budget, or it has increased the federal budget in general as another measure or attempt to provide stimulus for the overall economy. And as part of that, defense budget increased as well. So seen from that perspective, again, you can see that, yes, the defense budget increased, But the overall budget increased as well. But that's not a guarantee that, as Malcolm pointed out, the dire economic predicament of Japan in general will improve significantly. At the same time, I think we have to say that defense spending is below 1% of GDP, and should the security environment deteriorate rapidly or significantly to a point where China is really pushing the envelope, I think then you would have a greater room for maneuver for Abe to significantly increase defense spending. But we also have to keep in mind all the time that so far Japan is operating under the protective umbrella of the US alliance. In other words, it is not automatically necessary for Japan to rapidly increase defense spending.
Mm. All right, well, now we've talked a little bit on the hard defense side of things, I want to talk a little bit about the softer side of Abe's policies. Malcolm, in your paper, you noted about growing regional security cooperation and enhanced bilateral relationships. I would just like you to point out perhaps a couple of the highlights of what's happened under Abe, perhaps a little bit about what the relationships with Southeast Asia and other countries like South Korea have been.
Yeah, if you look, Abe, Japanese prime ministers traditionally don't travel very much because of the nature of the Japanese political system. But in his first year in office, Abe visited each of the 10 Southeast Asian capitals, and he's been to most of them two or three times now in his first 3 years. So certainly the Prime Minister Abe is putting actions behind the words that Japan wants to re-engage or rebalance towards East Asia as well. Some of the key kind of highlights are certainly in the case of the Philippines, the promise to provide up to 10 maritime surveillance ships, either free as they've done before or with very concessionary financing Philippines, which will significantly improve the Philippines' ability to keep an eye on what's going on in the archipelago. They've also previously given maritime surveillance ships to Indonesia for the same reason. And in the last visit to Vietnam, Japan made the similar offer, and Vietnam created a coast guard out of Japanese aid money to be used to provide coast guard vessels to Vietnam as it can't provide to the Navy. This year, at the same time, the Japanese budget is under review, and it looks very likely that they may approve the use of Japanese aid money, is like maritime surveillance and maritime domain awareness capabilities, which would enhance Japan's ability outside of the defense and ship provide morbidities to Southeast Asia and the Pacific Islands.
All right, I think we caught most of that, yep. Ben, I just wanted to ask, are there any other countries with whom Japan is really stepping up cooperation in the region? Taiwan, is that a relationship there they're looking into?
Taiwan is a very interesting case, and certainly there's potential to do more. But I think, you know, two other relationships are worth mentioning. Of course, one is with Australia. Because there's a very close relationship between Prime Minister Abe and Tony Abbott. We don't know yet whether the submarine deal or cooperation on submarines will come about, but the degree to which they have both sides have interacted on this issue and continue to discuss really points to a potentially really significant improvement in the relationship. And the other one is India. Apart from intensifying relations with a number of Southeast Asian countries, Japan has also stepped up strategic dialogue with India, including cooperation on the possible transfer of a Japanese surveillance plane, maritime surveillance plane to India, which is an interesting development. You mentioned South Korea. I think this is one of those, shall we say, work in progress, still very volatile relationship. And of course, the big question now moving forward is what comes of the Abe handshake with Xi Jinping? Can the two sides move a little bit towards each other, or was that just a symbolic handshake because simply the disagreements over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands are too big? So in other words, good news is that I think they can now start to acknowledge that there is a problem. They can find ways, hopefully, to manage their dispute, but it's rather unlikely that they will solve this problem.
Malcolm, I want to turn to you for a second. Two questions. First, I want to get your reaction on the state of China-Japan relations. And second, I just want you to talk a little bit about the role of leaders and leadership in all of these bilateral relationships.
In the Ishito at APEC, with that painful handshake, the day after, both sides offering interpretations of what the four points meant. So the Japan and China are in a very deep structural rivalry I don't think is going to change, and Xi Jinping and Abe are both conservative nationalists, which will probably add to the problem. Yeah, so when it comes to the question of whether leadership matters, certainly South Korea relations, President Park Geun-hye has led to a significant deterioration in those leaders, with the South Korean president refusing to meet the Japanese prime minister. On the positive side, the Australia-Japan relationship under Abbott and Abe certainly has benefited from the close personal relationship between those two leaders that spent hours in unedited personal meetings. Close relationship. As we saw with the close relationship a decade ago between Koizumi and Howard.
I just wanted to ask, though, I mean, given the closeness of the relationship that Malcolm's discussing, if the leaders change, what can we do today to strengthen the relationship to ensure that it doesn't just hinge on the personalities of those running the place?
Well, I guess, I mean, relationships are always important, but so are interests. And I think the fact that Australia and Japan have gotten closer to each other over the years is also a reflection of mutual interest. And despite the fact that we have had changes in government, has not necessarily meant that the relationship, grew colder. I think what we have to do now, moving forward, is try to foster those relationships, this relationship, but also, do a little bit of expectation management, because the expectations are really high now, and maybe rightly so. But it's, for example, not guaranteed that we will have a submarine deal. It is not guaranteed that a future prime minister on either side will put as much emphasis into the relationship. I think it also very much depends on the external circumstances. So if China, for example, continues to do what it's doing in the South China Sea and East China Sea, then I think the external pressure to further improve the relationship are very good. I think we have reached the stage in the relationship where you can really say this is Australia's second most developed and important strategic relationship in Asia after the United States. And a lot of it is day-to-day business, which is a good development.
Malcolm, do you have anything to add in terms of strengthening the Australia-Japan relationship other than leadership?
Yeah, I think if you look at the last 10 years, the strengthening is already being very evident, so I think it's very healthy. And probably one of the key developments is the kind of greater connection between Japanese and Australian defense and foreign affairs. I have a personal, professional commitment to the relationship with Japan, and the other way has increased significantly over the last 10 years, nowhere to the level of those connections with the U.S., but certainly much stronger than it was 10 years ago, which means leadership changes in either country will not have as significant an impact as if those kind of mid and lower range networks weren't in place.
Actually, excellent. Thanks for that. Look, I just want to turn now to something that's been in the news to do with Japan. It's been in the news recently that two Japanese hostages have been taken by ISIS, and now they're asking the Japanese government to pay ransom. I would just like to actually ask both of you some comments about what this might mean for Japan's engagement in future, whether they'll be as willing to put their people in harm's way. Malcolm, could I start with you?
I guess if you go way back in Peru, a group of Japanese civilians was taken hostage by a terrorist group, the Shining Path, a long time ago, and it seems pretty clear that the Japanese government paid ransom to allow them to be freed, or were going to before President Fujimori in Peru invaded the hostage-taking area and freed them. I think this time the Abe government pay ransom, it will shift Japan's commitment to its global security role. Also, I think Japan, given its worst security environment, is not going to bend on this one as it seemed to have done in the past.
Ben?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think we have to realize that Japan has been expanding its role for quite some time. So it has sent combat engineers to Iraq, even during the heydays of the counterinsurgency stabilization operations. It has been refueling American warships, supporting them in the operation in Afghanistan. These two people that have been abducted were not, you know, in the Japanese troops, but you know, journalists, and therefore I can't see how Japan would change its foreign policy or security policy behavior. I actually think that if anything, the opposite might be the case, that Japan, at least silently, is trying to do everything to support international efforts against ISIS, which now even includes countries such as China.
All right, and for our final question today, I just wanted to ask both of you your thoughts on 2015. What's the one thing we should watch out for regarding Japan this year?
I guess from a worrying perspective, if there was another incident in the East China Sea, as we saw in 2010 when the Chinese fishing trawler crashed into a Japanese coast guard, if something like that were to happen again, that could create a very serious problem. So for those who worry, because I think that's the most worrying scenario for Japan in 2015.
All right, fingers crossed it doesn't happen. Ben, over to you.
I would actually think two issues are really important. One is there are local elections in Japan this year, and many Japanese watchers actually say that they are more important than the federal elections, because they will also give an indicator as to the power base of Abe. And the other one, I would say, that apart from the nightmare scenario that Malcolm outlined, developments in the U.S.-Japan defense alliance. So what will the revised guidelines bring, and will, for instance, both sides be able to move on the never-ending saga in Okinawa over the replacement of the Marine Expeditionary Forces? That would be really a significant step forward in the relationship, but it's hampered with a lot of question marks after the last elections in Okinawa.
All right. We'll be sure to add those to our Google Alerts for 2015 then. Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for your time. To our listeners, if you'd like to catch any more of Malcolm Cook's work, he's got a paper co-authored with Thomas Wilkins called Aligned Allies, the Australia-Japan Strategic Partnership, which outlines a lot of what he discussed today, and that can be found on www.tokyofoundation.org, and you can catch more of his work at ISEAS. And Dr. Ventria's work, of course, is also found on ASPE's blog, The Strategist, at www.aspestrategist.org.au, and he has an upcoming piece on Japan. Gentlemen, thank you again for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And to all our listeners, again, you can catch us on iTunes for past episodes of Sea Control. Follow us on Twitter at SimSec, or follow the blog at simsec.org. Thanks for joining me again. Bye-bye.